The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay. So, as I said last week, I'd like to do Q&A today, questions and answers. So, what are your questions? They can be anything. They can be about practice. They can be about topics, Buddhist topics. They can be whatever. Whatever is your interest. Yeah. And the mic is right in front of you. Oh, maybe it needs a battery.
So, I'd like to ask about long retreats and developing concentration that always intrigued me and interested me and I thought very important. As opposed to then you leave the retreat and go out in the world and the concentration is gone. And it's a memory, and of course there's knowledge, information, etc., you know, your experiences. But that always was very attractive. You're presenting a very different approach, I think. And I'd like to know more about that.
Okay, so let me just see if I understand the question and the context of the question. So you're interested in kind of the relationship between concentration and retreat and how, you know, if you go on retreat and develop some concentration, that often that dissipates when you come back. And perhaps interested in exploring a little bit about that terrain. And then you mentioned that the approach that I generally teach here, it's much more of an open style, not so much the focus on the primary object, the concentration. So are you interested in kind of how it all fits together? Or
how it fits together. On the surface, they seem quite different. My guess is, but it's only a guess, that they lead to the same place.
Mm-hmm.
But I walk that walk, so I don't know what that's like.
Okay, so this is a big topic. Let's see what I can say. So first of all, the thing that occurs to me to mention is that there's two kinds of concentration. There's two different kinds of concentration. There's a concentration that we mostly think about or understand as concentration, which is where we focus on one experience, the breath, for example, and the mind settles down as we pay attention to that. The mind becomes very collected and unified around that one experience. So it's just... The settling of the mind happens through the kind of stabilizing on one object. It's a very powerful tool for concentrating the mind, for settling the mind down. I mean, the mind is often all over the place. You know, it runs off into thoughts of the past or the future. It leaps into ideas and plans and arguments, and it's just all over the place. And this gives it a really clear focus to settle it down. So it's very helpful to do this. The other kind of concentration is what we could call moment-to-moment concentration, which is a stability of mind that begins to happen as the mindfulness is continuous on changing experience. So in this kind of concentration, there's no need for the mind to settle on any one experience, but the awareness needs to to stabilize so that it can be present for the flow of experience. You might be present for sound, then the breath, then a thought, then an emotion, then a body sensation, a pressure, a tension, and then the mind might be interested in that pressure and tension and might explore the changing nature of that pressure and tension for a while. And then a sound appears and the mind just picks up the sound. The stability isn't around the objects in that or the experience in that situation. It's around the mind's ability to stay present and not get lost in thought. So there are two different approaches to concentration. They're both effective for different purposes in a way. The settling of the mind in concentration really lets the mind become very clear about one thing. The opening to a field of changing experience is much more the clarity of awareness itself, in a way. It's not so much that, we can become very clear on the objects that are in the changing flow of experience, but the most important thing is the stability of the awareness. Actually, in both cases, the awareness is stable, but in the case of the concentration on one object, stability of awareness is dependent on that object. And so if, you're dependent on that staying on that object like the breath, and then the sound of the beeping of a truck comes along, it may be hard to stay with that experience. And so the cultivation of that kind of concentration often takes a lot of, it can take very specific conditions, silent conditions. This is why it's easier to do on retreat in a way, that the conditions are more set up for that kind of concentration. Also in our daily lives, the mind is so busy that it can take a while for it to settle down on one thing. That kind of concentration cultivates some very beautiful states of mind. That focused concentration cultivates very beautiful states of mind, very pleasant experience. The body experience becomes pleasant. The body can even fall away altogether, and it's just this experience of peacefulness. So very pleasant experience in that type of practice. Very attractive. Feels really good. The open awareness may not actually feel as good, although we can get to a place where it's very balanced, very equanimous, very calm in the mind, and yet very active in the experiences. You could be sitting in the middle of a fire station and, just take in the flow of chaos and be completely present and aware and balanced and feel pretty relaxed about it. And yet the experience is one of a lot of change. So those are the two different kinds of concentration. Concentration of stabilizing on an object is a useful training for the mind, but in and of itself, it doesn't generally, if that's your only practice, it doesn't generally lead to wisdom. The mind kind of just knows that one thing. In this practice, the understanding is that wisdom comes through the meeting of impermanence, meeting of change. And with the concentration on one object, essentially what happens with that, you're paying attention to the breath. You're paying attention to the breath, the feeling of the breath. And over time, for the mind to really stabilize, the experience needs to become really stable. So we no longer are actually paying attention to the physical sensations, the changing experience of the breath. What we actually start paying attention to is a concept of the breath, an idea of the breath. And that idea becomes really stable. Ideas can stabilize in our mind they can become very, very fixed. And so the mindfulness kind of, I mean, the concentration absorbs into that fixed idea. So there's not much change happening in that experience. Now, that the practice, though, concentrates and focuses the mind such that when that state falls apart, when that state of concentration comes to an end, which it will because it is a constructed state, it's an impermanent phenomenon. So at some point, that state of concentration will come to an end. The mind can only do that for so long. And in that concentration state coming to an end, the concentration falls apart, the mind is very in a very good place to observe the change of how that state falls apart. And so the insight or the wisdom that comes from the cultivating that focused concentration comes from the observing the impermanence of that state itself. In the open awareness, the insight comes through the seeing the changing nature of all experience. We're not necessarily stabilizing on one object. Now, the concentration, depending on your mind, I mean, minds are so different. Some minds have a much easier time maintaining a continuity of awareness on one thing. Some minds are really happy to say, oh, breath, I don't have to worry about anything else, you know, just keep coming back. Some minds do that pretty naturally, pretty easily. Other minds are much more comfortable in a place of taking in a range of experience, kind of settling back and just noticing the flow of changing experience. Some minds, it's easier for them to get relaxed in that way. And so these two techniques, and there's a range actually of techniques along the spectrum of these different kinds of practices, of the two different kinds of concentration I've talked about, there's a range of techniques that follow the spectrum. There's some that are kind of in the middle even, where the Mahasi technique that we kind of use here is a kind of middle kind of tool. We start with the breath, stabilize the mind on the breathing, on that one object, but we pay attention to the changing nature of the breathing. We stay connected with the sensations, the actual sensations of the breathing. So we're attuning to change. And we don't hold to that. When something strong comes along, a sound, we allow the mind to take that in. So we're not necessarily just staying with the breath. But it's a kind of a middle thing. It is encouraging a staying with one object and yet looking at the change of that experience. So that's a kind of a middle, in the middle approach technique. So different minds work differently along the range of the techniques. I think that we all need in our practice as a whole, over the course of our practice as a whole, we all need to learn how to do both sides. You know, if you start from the concentration side, settling down, you'll get to see some of the difficulty that you have staying with the breath. I mean, the hindrances, the five hindrances are typically the qualities of mind that keep us from settling with the breath, that the hindrances of sense desire, ill will, of sloth and torpor, sleepiness, of restlessness and of doubt. Those hindrances kind of keep us from settling down. And you'll see, you know, you're paying attention to the breath and the mind goes off into fantasy. Oh, okay, come back. So, you know, you're pulled into some sense desire, or you're paying attention to the breath and there's an unpleasant sensation in your knee, and there's ill will around that. There's a feeling of frustration. So the mind gets pulled to that. And so over the course of the settling and concentration, the mind gets a little bit of an education about how it reacts to things. So there's a lot of learning that happens in the settling process in concentration. And yet there's a lot that can also be avoided in that kind of practice. You know, a lot of things that wouldn't necessarily come up, a lot of emotional reactivity or habitual patterns might or might not show up in that. And as a person gets more and more facile and skilled at that kinds of concentration, in general, it's easier and easier over time. And you can just sit down and the mind like, yeah, this is good. I like this. I'll go right to this experience. And at that point, we can kind of say, you know, make an end run around our difficulties, you know, like we could be struggling with something. It's like, you know, I just need a break from this. I'm just going to sit down. And we, you know, attend to our breathing and get a break. And that's very helpful. It's a very, very useful tool to have. The other approach of kind of just meeting experience, whatever's happening, I just taught a retreat where this was the whole practice. We weren't doing any kind of settling the mind on any one object. The whole instruction was very simple. Know that you're aware and notice what you're aware of. You know, just take it in. And when I introduced the retreat, I said, you know, you could call this retreat Your Mind 101, because what you will see as you open up your mind to just what's happening is how your mind does what it does in all of its messiness. So that kind of approach, it can take a longer time for the mind to settle down. You know, the mind gets caught in its stuff more easily with that approach. And yet, we learn a lot about our minds. We learn a lot about the difficulties. We learn a lot about the ways we react. For me, that approach has really supported major unwinding of old patterns and habits, difficult identities that I've carried around. So, you know, that broader approach of really just getting to know your mind can be slower to settle, and yet a great learning process for our minds. So both lead ultimately to the place where you can stabilize the attention in the present moment and observe how things change. And the mind is going to have to be pretty balanced, pretty equanimous to be in that place. The point in terms of Buddhist practice, they do come together in this place of being able to observe change in the present moment very clearly. The concentration practice may take you, depending on your mind, again, you know, some minds don't like to do that kind of concentration and can settle very slowly that way. But it can be a quicker route to that kind of stable awareness. But again, you may miss some of the transformation that can happen, that the practice can affect on old habits and patterns. So that's kind of an overview. But then there is a way in one person's practice that I think they can come together also. So in my own practice, I'll describe how this comes together for me. I started my practice with a very focused kind of practice, doing the, you know, focusing on the breathing. And this mind can do that. I mean, I was a computer programmer, and the mind has a very good capacity for narrowing down to one thing. And yet the way that I was approaching it was very tight. It was very rigid. And it was pretty brittle, the concentration that would develop from that. And I tied myself in knots and suffered a lot around the concentration. And then at some point I was introduced to this open style of practice, and it was a long road for me to actually shake up my mind to be able to not zero in. You know, my mind kind of naturally was zeroing in. And I didn't trust this open practice. I'm like, you know, how can that possibly work? So it took me a while to get there. And then I was introduced to this practice by my Burmese teacher, Tejaniya, whose basic approach was relax. relax and just notice what's happening. And I'm like, well, wow, really, how can that work at all? You're not doing anything. You know, I really had this view that I had to do something. But I, you know, okay, well, I'll see what happens. And it was amazing what I learned about my mind that way. Like I said, it was really my mind 101. And after spending 6 weeks in that style of just relaxing and noticing kind of this stream of stuff, whatever my mind decided to throw up, and all of the sights and sounds, and in Burma there were a lot of those. So, you know, just being with that stream, there was a kind of a relaxation that happened in my mind around an agenda that I had for my practice. And, you know, I thought, but at the end of that retreat, I thought, wow, this is my practice. I really understand this works really well for my mind. And yet I came back to the States and I realized that the mind at this point was ready to approach concentration in a new way. And so I started exploring that. And it took me a while to figure out how to navigate the concentration, because my mind kind of had this habit of zeroing in and holding on. But what I learned is that I can start with this open practice, just let the kind of experience flow. And at some point in that flow of experience, there will be a breath. And in that flow of experience, the way that I can now hang out in that flow of experience with very little agenda, very little need to do anything. And actually, to really settle into the concentration, it needs to have the same quality of mind. We can't really have an agenda or a pushing or a forcing. So what I learned is that that spaciousness that I connect with the open awareness, I could learn how to apply to one object. So I start my concentration practice from this open space of just letting experience flow. And then there's a breath. And then there's this kind of inclination, because I'm moving towards concentration, an inclination to connect with the breath. And almost immediately, every time still, there's a gripping down that happens as I try to do that. And so I let go. I just go back to the open awareness. And there's another breath, and I try again. And it's sort of like educating the mind slowly over time how to meet that breath without gripping, without tightening. How to meet that breath with that same spacious awareness as I meet the flow of experience. This has just transformed my concentration practice. You know, it's much more natural settling. It's very slow for me. It can take me an hour and a half to settle into a concentrated state. The mind is pretty slow about it. But that's the way this mind works. And, you know, that's okay. just kind of watch it very slowly be able to meet that experience. And I found that through the practice of concentration, you know, there's certain kinds or certain things that I've learned through the practice of concentration, of trying to construct a state of concentration. What I've really seen is that it's truly a practice of letting go. Concentration is a practice of letting go. You can't want it for it to really come to fruition. So I've learned a lot about releasing, relaxing through the practice of concentration that I then actually have learned, you know, to apply back to that open awareness practice, some kind of subtle kinds of clinging and holding that I wasn't aware of. You know, when I get to a particular place in meditation, the best thing I can do is to release and relax and not try to do anything. And it was interesting to me to see that even in that spacious awareness, there had been a very subtle doing that I didn't notice until I had gone through this concentration practice. So to me, they both aspects have been very helpful in my own practice. And I think So practicing the open awareness has helped to shake out the kind of striving tendencies. The concentration has helped me to see some subtle kinds of clingings that I wasn't seeing in the open awareness. So I think that cultivating both sides is really helpful. Now, the way each mind goes about it is going to be different, depending on your own mind. You know, it may be that concentration is more easy for you. You know, I have a friend that went at this from the other direction. You know, she started with concentration, and from that base of concentration, she needed that base of concentration to be able to open up to changing experience. It was too much for her to start from the open awareness. So, you know, different minds will have different experiences and different ways in. I like to suggest for people when they're doing a meditation practice, what's easiest for you? Start there. Start from what the easiest way to connect with your experience. All of the Dharma interconnects with all of the other pieces of the Dharma. If you're cultivating open awareness, concentration will develop. It may not be the one-pointed concentration, but concentration will develop. And in that spacious awareness, you will meet the fact that that open, non-judgmental awareness has a quality of metta to it. So you learn about metta through that. You don't necessarily need to practice the metta practice to learn about metta. You know, if you're practicing the one-pointed concentration, you're learning about the hindrances and the difficulties that obstruct the concentration. And you learn about the beautiful qualities that open your heart in the states that you move into are so opening in the concentration. Again, you move into the metta field. And in that concentration falling apart, you see the mindfulness of changing experience. So, you know, we can go in from any angle. And I truly believe that there's not one right path that's right for everybody. You know, it really depends on the mind. Now to address the other question you brought in around, you know, the concentration disappearing after retreat. I think partly, you know, if we go on retreat and we really do that focused kind of concentration without it being a letting go, if it's a holding on to, again, as I said, that's kind of brittle. So it will really naturally fall apart. And any state of concentration that you develop on retreat is going to fall apart, even if it's an open awareness. You know, the open awareness, the continuity of that awareness is dependent on the conditions of the retreat. And so that too will fall apart. And yet what I've seen in my own practice is that, you know, the concentration in daily life kind of lags behind the concentration that one's capable of meeting in retreat. But I've seen throughout the course of my practice, I mean, the first retreat I did was about 15 years ago now. And on those first few retreats, you know, I got a little bit concentrated. And it was really dramatically different than when I ended the retreat, I didn't know that I had really settled into concentration in those first few retreats, and that is this first, my first longer retreat, my first 10-day retreat. The end of that retreat, you know, I thought, well, you know, things seem pretty normal. I mean, I had been experiencing some kind of interesting phenomenon in the meditation, but I hadn't really noticed. You know, as you settle into a retreat, the letting go of things happens kind of slowly, and you know, you're not so aware of the moment-to-moment changing. But then we broke silence, and we started talking. And after that, I went back to take a shower. I'd been talking to some people, and I went back to take a shower, and it felt like there were 5 radios going on in my head at one time. And I was like, is this what my mind always does? I mean, is this the way my mind normally is? And I thought it probably was. I mean, this is the way my mind normally worked. Just, you know, constant thoughts from 8 different directions. And it was very disorienting. So in that moment, I recognized how settled the mind had been. You know, after we started talking, I realized how settled the mind had been. And so, you know, that kind of, you know, five radios going in my mind at once. My mind is pretty quiet these days. I kind of think that, and I don't have any objective way to measure this, but I think that my mind in its normal state right now is probably about the level of concentration that I achieved on those first, you know, retreats in that first year of practice. The mind can get much quieter now in retreat, and I come out. But there's much, actually also much less of a jarring quality, you know, that there's not so much of a difference between the mind off retreat and the mind on retreat in terms of its kind of base level of experience. There's a very great difference in terms of what the mind is capable of seeing because of the continuity of the mindfulness. You know, there's much more precise clarity around impermanence that the mind sees on retreat that it can sometimes touch into in daily life. If I hit a stretch of, you know, even a few minutes where the mindfulness is continuous, I can see some change pretty clearly in my daily life. So I think that, you know, retreat, it's a lifelong journey. And that on retreat, you know, the more we do retreat, the more we connect to it, the more it informs our daily life. And the more the insights and the wisdom that we gain on daily life feed back into our daily life. And also the settling that happens. You know, there's a kind of a natural settling that happens on retreat that somehow, you know, and I don't know how it happens, but somehow the mind begins to let go of some of the busyness that it engages in daily life somehow through this practice. And I do equate it with having gone on retreats, but you know, there's one story of a woman, and this, I like to tell this story because it's very inspiring. You know, this woman, she was an older woman, I think in her late 60s, early 70s. And I know about her because there was a book of letters that she wrote to her meditation teacher. The book is called Freed Freedom, and I don't know how you can get a copy of it. I have a Xeroxed copy, and that's all. But it's about this woman, and it's over the course of about 7 years, these letters that she wrote to her meditation teacher. Maybe about every, you know, month or so, she'd write a letter, describe her experience, and get some guidance back from her teacher again by a letter. So you get this correspondence, sometimes the letter from her, sometimes the letter from the meditation teacher. And she was a householder. She lived in the midst of life. She had to take care of her son. She had a busy life. She couldn't go on retreat very much. You know, I think she got a little instruction early on at a short retreat. And so she meditated in her daily life, and she practiced mindfulness throughout her day. And I mean, she was very dedicated. She got up at like 2 o'clock in the morning and meditated from 2 to 6 a.m. every day. So 4 hours every day she would meditate. I tried it. I couldn't do it. I was so inspired after reading this. It's like, wow, this is great. So she meditated, you know, a few hours every day and made very great progress in her meditation. And, you know, from the descriptions of her practice, she got really, really free. At some point, her teacher said, it would be a good idea if you could come to the monastery for a week and meditate. I think it would support your progress. I don't know whether she ever made it. I mean, it was never logged in the correspondence, but you know, the possibility is there if you've got the inspiration. I mean, the level of freedom she attained was really remarkable in 7 years meditating on a daily basis. And that to me was just such an inspiration. I was like, wow, you know, you don't actually have to do retreat. Now, I think maybe some minds do. Maybe she had a remarkable mind, you know, but it's possible. So retreats aren't necessarily required for deep realization. It does help. I don't think I could do it without it.
I think the mind is really nice.
The Deepa, there's a book, Deepa Ma, the, it's a book about a woman, an Indian woman, and she's amazing too. She had an amazing mind. She had a natural capacity for meditation, but she didn't start meditating until she was much older too. But her life was one of suffering. She had lost her husband, her two of her children, I think, in a fairly short time, and
she lost her parents.
Her parents, that's right.
She was married at 12.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it's very like the story of the one woman in the sutta who lost her, you know, she lost her two children, her husband, and her parents, all within the space of like a week. Now, Deepa Ma was over the course of several years, but it really reminded me of this woman, how much suffering she experienced. She was so ill, you know, she knew she needed to meditate, and so she went to the monastery. She did spend time at the monastery, and She, in her first 10 days, she had this experience where she was doing walking meditation. She'd gotten the instructions one night. And the next day, she went. She was going back for her interview, and she was doing walking meditation. And while she was doing the walking, she stopped, and she found she couldn't move. And she wasn't alarmed. She just was noticing the sensations of not being able to move. And finally, she'd thought to look down. And she looked down, and there was a dog that had grabbed a hold of her ankle. And it was biting her. And she hadn't felt the pain. She had been so concentrated that she was just noticing sensation. So she had a very powerful capacity for concentration very quickly. But she spent her time in the monastery, learned the meditation practice, but she went back to her place in Calcutta. She lived in this flat in Calcutta, and she thought, you know, the women here need meditation. I've got to teach them meditation, and she started teaching them how to be mindful while suckling their babies, while stirring the rice, and her whole teaching became one of daily life practice. Even though she did a lot of her training in the monastery and through concentration practice, she found a very natural movement to daily life exploration. And she said there's one story of a woman who, you know, had her moment of deep liberating insight while suckling her baby. So, you know, it's called Deepa Ma, the D-I-P-A. The book study group is doing is reading that book right now. It's a short book. It's available on like Amazon, but the spelling is D-I-P-A-M-A. So you can find it on Amazon. Well, that was a 45 minute question. Okay. We'll let somebody else ask the next question. Deepa is the Pali word Deepa, and I don't know whether that was her name, whether that was the name her teacher gave her. I think it was actually.
That was the name she gave her daughter.
Oh, that's right. It was the name she gave her daughter, and Deepa Ma was mother of Deepa, right? So Deepa, the Pali word for Deepa is either lamp or light. Or island. So some of the final words of the Buddha, he said, be a light unto yourself, be an island unto yourself. And the word he used was Deepa. So that's what the word Deepa means. Yeah.
This might be an easy one.
Let's get the...
So normally, like temperature-wise, I run kind of cold.
Is it on?
But when I'm meditating, a lot of times I get hot. And I'm wondering if that's kind of normal, if something happens.
I can't speak for you. You need to look at it in your own experience. I found, this is interesting, you know, I found that when I was first starting meditation, you know, I was in the meditation hall, and I was, you know, focused on my breath, and I was like, I think it was a lot of energy, you know, a lot of energy was created through the attention. And I was You know, I would be in there with a short sleeve shirt on, and everybody else would be bundled up in blankets. You know, so I generated a lot of heat early on in my practice. And then there was one point where the teacher suggested, don't do anything. Just sit there and just watch what happens. When I started doing that, I got really cold. So to me, there was a connection with the amount of, you know, kind of directed energy that was put into the meditation and the heat. And now what I have happen now is I'm at the stage of having hot flashes. And if I bring in a tightening or focusing of the attention, it will almost always trigger a hot flash. So to me, at least in my mind, there is a connection between the energy and the effort made and the heat. But check in your own experience. You know, you could notice if, at least in my own experience, I think that the heat was related to an over-efforting. So check and see if there's a little bit of over-efforting going on, if there can be a little bit of letting go of the effort and still staying present. If, you know, the heat may be unconnected to that for you. So, you know, explore it in your own experience. You have a question?
I'm bringing up our son, and he was the most unlikely person that I ever thought would be interested in meditation, and something was happening at work where a course was offered, part of it was free, and then if you wanted to continue, you know, this person was available, and he got into it because he had a lot of tension, and it really helped him with this tension. Also, he felt it helped his breath, that it made him, you know, made him breathe better. So he was in it for, you know, sort of pragmatic reasons. And he says now, and he's still going, you know, but he says, my mind will never be able to settle in on one thing. He says, I just got that kind of a mind. And I can't, things come and go, you know, and I was wondering, is there any little word of wisdom to someone who, I don't know if your mother is the proper one to give it to him, but just something, we're just so happy for him because he, you know, he knew that we meditated sometimes, but he was like, that's fine, you know, he wasn't really interested, and then this person came in who seems to be having an impact on him. And I would like to encourage him in some way, but I don't really want to, I don't know that he'd accept it anyways, but
yeah.
Is there anything you would say, maybe this would help?
Well, yeah, how old is he?
He's 47.
Does he have, is your sense of him, I mean, there's certain minds that have like, attention deficit disorder, that mm-hmm. do have a lot of trouble kind of staying with one thing. They're kind uh-huh. of very naturally scattered. And, you know, that kind of mind, it's usually easiest to start with the open awareness. And it sounds like for him, I would start with, you know, the open awareness. I don't know if the instructions he's been given are probably around the breath.
Yes, I think so.
You know, mm-hmm. that's the typical kind of instruction. And so, you know, he probably is there for a minute and then moves off and moves, mm-hmm. you know, so it's a kind of a back and forth kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there are other ways of meditating that are kind of just settling back and watching that flow. And if he's got enough experience with what it means to be aware, mm-hmm. you know, if you have enough experience of just understanding what awareness is, that kind of open style of awareness that I was talking about earlier, it takes an understanding of what it is, what awareness is, mm-hmm. because it's so easy to confuse that open awareness, and it merges really kind of into thinking. You know, and, mm-hmm. and it can be a gray area where you're not really sure whether you're present or not. And so that open style of awareness does take an understanding of what it means to be present, what it means to be aware. And given his training with the one thing, you know, he may be able to explore a more open awareness. You could, you know, one thing that might be interesting to start with is hearing. You know, the way we started our guided meditation. Oh, maybe you weren't here for that.
No, I got most of that. Thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, the hearing, opening to hearing, is much more this kind of receptive stream of experience. You don't have to try to stay with one thing. It's staying with the hearing, but, you know, it's allowing a flow of experience. And from that, he might be able to move into the flow of all experience and not needing to restrict it. You know, so it sounds like it might be skillful or helpful for him to find a teaching or a tool that works more naturally with the way his mind is. And, you know, my guess is that once the mind settles in that way through the open awareness, it will more naturally be able to settle on one thing. That it's kind of, you know, that sounds like his doorway. Mm-hmm. If he knows that his mind is always on many things, you know, that it kind of takes in a flow of experience, that's the place to begin.
And noticing.
And, yeah, noticing. Oh, there's a technique that's sometimes helpful. I've used it, I don't know if you've heard this particular technique, but it is recorded. There's a talk that I gave called Choiceless Awareness.
Choiceless
awareness, I believe, is what it was called. And in that, I talked about choiceless awareness, which is kind of a term for this broad, open awareness. Mm-hmm. And I gave a practice for connecting with open awareness. It's very simple. It's a kind of a simple, you can do it in pairs to start with. You can do it with another person and just narrate your experience. One person speaks, the other person listens. Now I'm aware of pressure. Now I'm aware of seeing. Now I'm aware of hearing. Now I'm aware of movement. Now I'm aware of dryness. So you're just kind of narrating your experience. What are you aware of moment to moment? That kind of is a doorway to this open awareness practice. And I describe it in that talk. So that's another. That's on the internet. Yeah, it's on Audio Dharma. Did you have one?
Comparing the two types of meditation, either focusing on your breath or an open awareness, I'm hearing, and also from experience, open awareness sometimes takes over whether you're trying to do that or not. But if you have that open awareness, you probably need more time for your sitting than you would if you tried to focus in on one thing, such as the breath.
Well, I think, you know, any amount of time meditating is useful. And, you know, if it's easier for you to start with the open awareness and you only have 20 minutes, that's what you can do. You know, for some people, I mean, like for myself, at this point, open awareness is easy. I can do that really easily. The focusing on one thing takes an hour and a half. If I want to do concentration practice, I need time. So for me, it's kind of flipped at this point. Now, initially, you know, when I first started my practice, I was, you know, it's easier sometimes when you start to just pick one thing because you don't really know what it means to pay attention. And so that begins to train you in that. So, you know, it varies. I wouldn't say there's a categorical answer to that question. I think it depends on the person, and it probably depends on how long you've been practicing. I think in terms of a retreat, an overall retreat, probably if you're just doing open awareness, the settling into the retreat, into the concentration state takes a little more time. The focused awareness can take you to a concentrated state more quickly over the course of a retreat. And yet in this retreat that I just taught, where we were doing this open awareness, it was amazing. I mean, it was a 10-day retreat. And I had taught a 3-week retreat of this kind, where it did take a while for people to settle down. This 10-day retreat had quite a number of fairly experienced practitioners in it. But, you know, I think by day five or six, some people were in some very spacious equanimous places. And one guy said, you know, he said, I'm going to go home and tell people, you know, what did I do? I relaxed and I noticed what was obvious, you know. and yet here I am, you know, in this amazing space. You know, so it's a powerful practice to just notice what is happening and not to direct the mind. But I think it does take longer to settle in.
How is open awareness much different from just having your mind flit from one thing to another?
How is open awareness different from having your mind flit from one thing to another? That's a great question. The key is the awareness piece. You know, when the mind is kind of just flitting around, often it's just kind of landing on this thought or that thought, or, you know, it's... Well, are you really aware? I mean, is there an awareness in the moment that you're thinking about it, or is it kind of in the retrospect that you know, oh, I was thinking about that? So usually, if the mind is thinking long chains of thought, there may be a little mindfulness in there, but it's not continuous. If there's a lot of thinking going on, generally the mindfulness is not continuous. So generally in the open awareness practice, what you may experience is kind of the attention picking up on many different experiences moment to moment. A pressure, a sight, a sound, a dryness. A thought might flit through, but the mind is not going to follow and think on that thought. It's not going to add thoughts to that thought. You know, there might be a memory that appears. You know, you see the color red, and then, you know, you have a memory of wearing a red shirt when you were 5 years old, and that memory is right there. But rather than then thinking about that memory and who you were with and what you did, that memory appears and disappears, and then there's a sound, and then so it's much more. Yeah, there's not the mind chaining off of what it experiences. And typically, I think, in what you're describing, the flitting from thing to thing, generally there is a thinking about something. You know, you see a car, and then your eyes follow the car, and you start thinking about that kind of car. Oh, it's a Prius. Oh, I'd like to have a Prius. And we may think about that for like 30 seconds, and then there's something else, that we see a tree, and then we think, oh, that's a nice tree. I'd like to have that kind of tree in my yard. And we think about that for a little while, and then there's something else. We see a dog, and we like dogs or we don't like dogs, and we think about that for a little while. That, you know, so there's more of a chaining of thought in that kind of first state I think the flitting from thing to thing that you described. In the open awareness, it's much more just, there's less thinking. The papancha is the term, the mental proliferation. And even if that mental proliferation only lasts for a few moments, that's kind of in the way of the continuity of the mindfulness. Now, it is possible, and now I've got to stop, but I'll just leave us here. It is possible to be aware while thinking. It's a different kind of awareness. It's not quite as continuous, because, you know, the mind has to be, if we're conscious and thinking about the content of our thoughts and aware of that, there can be an awareness of that, of the content of our thoughts, but there's got to be, in order for that thinking to continue, the mindfulness, it's kind of like it has to be a little lighter touch. Because if the mindfulness is really right there, all you're going to see is a thought appear and disappear. You're not going to continue to think. But that could be a whole... Have I talked about being mindful of thinking lately? Have I talked about that? Should I talk about that next week? Okay. I'll talk about that next week. And we need to stop. So thank you all.